because Boris Johnson, in some respects, is a kind of anti-politician. He was seen as someone different from the rest. And that was why actually many of his supporters viewed his rule breaking with relative equanimity.
Hello and welcome back to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs, the entirely student-run podcast at Johns Hopkins University. I'm Lauren Zhao, and I'm here today with my co-host, Nicole Rivas. The next UK Prime Minister is scheduled to be announced on September 5th, immediately following the current Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. In this episode, we will discuss the fall and legacy of Boris Johnson, as well as the key candidates in the current race to become Prime Minister. We discuss the central domestic and foreign policy issues of each candidate's campaign and explore how each candidate will affect the UK's relationship with the EU and the US. Finally, we will delve into what each candidate means for the future of the UK.
Anand Menon is a professor of European politics and foreign affairs at King's College London. He's an associate fellow of Chatham House and senior associate member of Nuffield College, Oxford. He is co-editor of the journal West European Politics. Professor Menon is director of the UK in a Changing Europe, a unique initiative funded by the Economic and Social Science Research Council that aims to make findings of social scientific research accessible to all non-academic audiences interested in Brexit and its implications.
Anand, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So starting off, the UK Prime Minister elections are approaching quickly, and with the new Prime Minister scheduled to replace the current Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, at the beginning of September, could you just give us a little bit of a background on how this election came about and briefly run our listeners through the election process?
Yeah, I can do. I mean, it's surprisingly complicated in a way. I mean, the simple bit is we're having this competition now, this election now, because sufficient numbers of Boris Johnson's own MPs decided they no longer wanted him as Prime Minister, so he had to resign. And that was, and we can come back to this if you want, but it was a result of a multitude of things, partly perceptions of the government not being very competent, partly perceptions of it being borderline corrupt and bending the rules for its own purposes, partly, of course, because of the fuss over allegations about parties being held in Downing Street during lockdown. So Boris Johnson went because he lost the support of his own members of parliament. What happened next under Conservative Party rules is those same members of parliament were asked to vote in repeated rounds on who should succeed him. So you start off with a number of candidates, successive votes carried out very, very quickly. I think the whole process took about 2 weeks. Narrowed the field down to the two that we have now, which is Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss. But, and this is where it gets interesting, the second round of voting doesn't include MPs at all, but is done by members of the Conservative Party. Now, we don't know how many members of the Conservative Party there are, because the Conservative Party won't tell us, but the best guess is about 180,000 people. So those 180,000 people get to decide not just the new leader of the Conservative Party, but because the Conservatives are in power, the new Prime Minister of the UK as well.
Yeah, so you already gave us a little bit of context about this dramatic fall of Boris Johnson, which was very stark contrast to his landslide victory in 2019. So I was wondering if you could give us a little bit more specific details to provide a little bit more context on the various scandals surrounding his cabinet and party officials and maybe a little bit more factors that contributed to his resignation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one point worth making to start off with is, you know, in British politics at the moment, we're dealing with three distinct electorates. So there is the electorate itself, the British people who vote in general elections, who provided Boris Johnson with that 80-seat majority. There are Conservative MPs who kicked him out and did the first bit of replacing him, and there are Conservative members. And what's quite interesting, and we'll come on to this, is the fact that, you know, what one group wants to hear is not necessarily the same as what the other groups want to hear, which creates some interesting dynamics. But I think with Boris Johnson, there were several things. I mean, firstly, there was a growing sense, and I think this is crucial, amongst his colleagues that he was no longer the sort of electoral asset that he once was. Boris Johnson had always been seen as someone uniquely capable of winning elections. I think that was always exaggerated. I don't think Boris Johnson was ever as popular as some of his fans would try and make you believe. I mean, he during the 2019 election, although he won the 2019 election with that large majority, at every stage of the 2019 election campaign, Boris Johnson was actually less popular than Theresa May had been at the equivalent stage of the 2017 campaign, which tells you something. The difference between the two elections in 2017 and 2019 was that by 2019, Jeremy Corbyn was almost sort of biblically unpopular, and so he was a relatively easy opponent to face. So I think the background to the ousting of Boris Johnson is very clearly this sense that we were willing to tolerate him as long as he was a winner, but given his numerous other flaws that I'll come on to in a minute, are we willing to tolerate those in someone who is now actually behind in the opinion polls? And the other flaws, I think, were a sense that the government was disorganized, a sense that the cabinet that he appointed was a cabinet of people who didn't really have much in the way of talent, that he was breaking the rules in Downing Street. I think the reports and the photographs and the videos about parties being taking place in Downing Street at a time when the whole country was in lockdown very, very badly damaged Boris Johnson's reputation. And of course, intervening in all of this, and I think this was probably the final nail in the coffin, was that the Conservative Party lost a couple of by-elections in very different places, one in the so-called Red Wall seat of Wakefield, which was a new Conservative seat in the north of England, in the relatively sort of less prosperous north of England, and one in a traditional southern Conservative seat where the Conservatives had a majority of over 20,000, which is huge. And I think this perception that Boris Johnson wasn't doing his job very well, compounded by a sense that he was actually starting to be an electoral liability, were what ultimately did for him.
And you alluded to, you know, his worst failures in office. But looking back on his legacy as one of the most controversial figures in politics, what have been his most crowning achievements and his worst failures? And what do you see the impact he will have on the future of UK politics?
Okay, well, in terms of achievements, I mean, clearly he got the UK out of the European Union, which is something his predecessor failed to do. I think you have to give the government a significant amount of credit for the speed and success of the vaccine rollout during the pandemic. We're going to have an inquiry into the handling of the pandemic, and I think we'll find that significant mistakes were made during that as well, though I think the vaccine rollout is an undoubted success. Boris Johnson does have an ability to connect with the electorate and with parts of the electorate that maybe aren't that interested in politics that is rare among politicians. And I think, you know, he was notable for that. The other thing that I think is interesting to say about Boris Johnson is it's not just his legacy, but I think what his election represents that is interesting, because Boris Johnson, in some respects, is a kind of anti-politician. He was seen as someone different from the rest. And that was why actually many of his supporters viewed his rule breaking with relative equanimity, because Boris Johnson was the sticking two fingers up at the political establishment candidate. So I think it's not just the fact that he did certain things in power, but I think it was also the fact that the election of someone like Boris Johnson partly depended on a generalized loss of faith in politics that meant that people turned to someone who maybe wasn't seen as being competent, but was seen as being a bit different and a bit of a laugh.
And how would you say this affected the popularity of the Conservative Party?
Well, this is what we're going to find out. I think it's too soon to say. The Johnson brand was very badly tarnished by his last 6 to 12 months in power. There's no doubt about that. That Johnson brand translated into defeats for the Conservative Party. What we don't know is the degree to which the Conservative brand can be recovered under a new leader. The Conservatives have historically been very, very good at reinventing themselves under new leaders. So Boris Johnson has essentially, when he was elected in December 2019, effectively said, this is a fresh start. And the British people seem to buy that, even though the Conservatives have been in power since 2010. So we'll have to wait and see what happens with Boris Johnson's successor. But of course, it's worth pointing out that the context is very, very different indeed now. The context now is one where everyone is talking only about the economy, about the rising cost of living. We had our latest inflation figures out today in the United Kingdom, and inflation, sort of household goods inflation, is topping 10%, which is the highest it's been since 2008. And people are getting very, very worried about a winter fuel crisis and about a winter cost of living crisis. So actually, those days of Boris Johnson where we were all talking avidly about parties and what happened and what didn't happen, and that was a major news event, seems a long, long time ago now. So I think we'll just have to wait till there is a new person in and see what the initial polling says before we can be certain if the Conservatives can recover or not.
Right. Speaking of waiting on the right person in, could you give our listeners a little bit more information about the key candidates of the current election and their election approaches?
Yeah. I mean, there are two candidates left. One is Rishi Sunak, who is a man of Indian origin. He was formerly the Chancellor of the Exchequer, so Treasury Secretary in your language. And his opponent is Liz Truss. Liz Truss is a fascinating politician in the sense that she manages to change her mind completely and get away with it. She was an avid supporter of Remain during the referendum, has become one of the most ardent Brexiters subsequent to Leave winning in the referendum. She is still, because she never resigned from government, the UK foreign secretary. And they have very different approaches. I mean, given that the economy has dominated the election contest, I'll talk about that a little bit. Rishi Sunak is setting himself up as the rational candidate, the one who says, look, we can't just go out there and cut taxes or spend money. We have to balance the books. We've got to be cautious. We need to think through what our decisions mean for the future sustainability of the UK economy. Liz Truss, on the other hand, has limited herself largely to saying, I will deal with the current crisis by cutting taxes. She's appealing directly, if you like, to the spirit of Margaret Thatcher within the Conservative Party. But I think an important caveat, which goes back to my earlier point about different electorates, is some people see this contest as a bit like in the United States, you have primaries and then general elections, and candidates will tack away from the positions they've taken during primaries to become more centrist when they're facing the population as a whole. Some people think that both candidates are basically playing that game. They're talking to Conservative Party members, and Conservative Party members tend to be older, white, and affluent. So talking to them about tax cuts is very sensible. But what we don't know is that when on the 5th of September we get a prime minister, whether they'll actually start saying something very different to what they said during the campaign, because the electorate then becomes the British people rather than these 180,000 Conservative Party members.
How do you see, I guess, when one of these candidates do get elected to one of the position, how do you see their visions changing and their actions changing based on what the British people want?
It's impossible to say. Because if you think about the factors at play here, there are personal beliefs. Liz Truss, who is the favourite by a long way at the moment to win, has always been an avid free marketeer, a sort of child of Margaret Thatcher, if you like. She has espoused that sort of free market supply side reform approach to the economy. Then there are the promises you've made to MPs in order to get to this position in the first place. And that we don't know, all the backroom deals that have been made, what she said to whom, not just about cabinet positions, but about what she will do when she, if and when she becomes prime minister. And finally, of course, there'll be what the polls tell her. This week, we've had an interesting episode where the opposition Labour Party has unveiled a plan to deal with the energy crisis. And there was some polling released that showed around 4/5 of Conservative voters favoured the Labour approach. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if whoever wins this contest, and it looks likely to be Liz Truss at the moment, changes their approach quite significantly once they've won, but within the constraints set by the need to keep their party in parliament together and whatever promises they've made to fellow MPs.
Yeah. Speaking of, I guess, the economy and the energy issue, what are other core domestic issues at the forefront of this election? And how do the two candidates say they will address these domestic issues?
To be honest, there is only one domestic issue in this election, and it is the cost of living. The cost of living is dominating the news cycle. It is all that anyone's talking about. It is all that people are picking up on in terms of the debate between the two candidates. It is the Sunak vision for sort of responsible economics, as he sees it, versus tax-cutting trusts. And to be perfectly honest, no other issue is really getting a look in. They might get a quick mention at some of the hustings. So planning laws around allowing houses to be built has been one sort of very, very brief argument between the two candidates, but it's quickly got swamped again. I mean, it's hard to exaggerate the degree to which the cost of living has become the single issue in British domestic politics at the moment.
Yeah, I guess moving on to what we do best, what are the main foreign policy strategies of each candidate?
Well, as ever in these things, there's not been that much said about foreign policy. There's been a slight spat over China, where Liz Truss has been more hawkish than Rishi Sunak, which meant that Rishi Sunak went off and came back with a more hawkish position than he'd had previously. So they bid each other up a bit in terms of China. The governing Conservative Party is dominated by China hawks at the moment. And I think one of the things we will see going forward, whoever wins, but particularly if it's Liz Truss, is a hardening of that position on China. The question that we don't know the answer to is where that balance will lie between being critical of the Chinese regime and still wanting to trade with the Chinese. But I think, you know, gone are the days of that golden era signaled by David Cameron of UK-Chinese relations. Those relations will not recover to that point in the near future. It's interesting to point out that on Ukraine, both candidates say virtually the same thing. I mean, Liz Truss has said some fairly remarkable things about how she has stood up to President Putin that strike me as somewhat exaggerated. But anyway, they're the major international issues that have been raised during this campaign. The other one, of course, is relations with the EU. I think we can expect both candidates to adopt a fairly strong position towards the European Union. Both are committed to this piece of legislation, the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, that could well trigger a trade war with the EU, because the EU sees the bill as a breach of our treaty obligations with the treaty we signed with them back in 2019. So I think there are tiny differences over China. There are slight nuances over Brexit, where Liz Truss has come across as slightly tougher, I think. But in foreign policy terms, there isn't that much to choose between them, I wouldn't say.
Got you. And I guess following straight after Johnson's leadership, do you see any obstacles these two candidates might be facing?
My God, I mean, it's hard to see anything other than obstacles. I mean, you know, you've got the global energy crisis, you've got the war going on in Ukraine, you've got a very difficult set of decisions to take over the European Union, you've got spiraling prices at home, we have a shortage of labor, which isn't helping either inflation or the economy as a whole. There is a very, very long list of problems, in substantive policy problems facing whoever becomes prime minister. And on top of that, there are political problems. And I think the two political problems to stress are, firstly, the fact that the Conservatives are behind in the polls. That will be a cause for concern. Whoever gets in needs to not only figure out a way of making the Conservative Party popular again, but doing so in the middle of what could turn out to be the worst economic crisis we've had for 30-odd years. And the second issue facing a new leader is that the Conservative Party in Parliament is profoundly divided on fundamentals of economic policy, but divided in a way that has become worse through this leadership election, because one of the defining features of this election has been the way in which Conservative MPs have disagreed fundamentally and often quite rudely with each other about the basics of policy. So putting that party back together again after what has been a very, very bruising leadership election is going to be no mean feat.
And I know you mentioned the Northern Ireland bill, and I was just wondering if you could give a brief overview. I was just curious.
Yeah, okay. So as part of the Brexit deal back in 2019, Boris Johnson signed something called the Northern Ireland Protocol with the European Union. And the protocol was an agreement to avoid a hard border between the north and the south of Ireland by essentially introducing some checks on goods between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. It's a weird agreement, you know, if you look at it in comparative terms, because it was an agreement that there would be some kind of internal border between two parts of the same country. So Great Britain and Northern Ireland are both parts of the United Kingdom, but there will be an internal border between the two to prevent the need for a border between the north and south of Ireland. Now, the two sides have subsequently fallen out over the protocol. The European Union argues that the UK isn't living up to its obligations because it's not carrying out the checks. The UK is saying that the EU is being ridiculous in insisting on such a high level of compliance for an internal border, and that the EU is trying to provoke a fight. Anyway, whatever the rights and wrongs of what the two sides are saying, we've ended up in a situation where the UK government has introduced a bill in Parliament, the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, that gives the UK government the right to unilaterally stop applying parts of the Northern Ireland Protocol. Okay, now that would be legal under UK law. What the EU are saying, however, is you can't unilaterally legislate to change the operation of a bilateral agreement, because if you do so, you're in breach of terms of the bilateral agreement. So what the European Union have said quite clearly is if this bill becomes law, we will retaliate. And that retaliation might include, for instance, suspension of parts of the trading relationship with the United Kingdom. So I hope that was clear enough.
No, yes, definitely clear. And I guess on the topic of EU-UK relations, what will this election mean for relations between the two?
I think relations between the two, by everything you can judge at the moment, are going to remain frosty, lukewarm, and relatively tense, certainly until the protocol issue is sorted. And there has been nothing during this contest to date that makes one confident that that's going to be the case. Now, clearly, again, the Conservative Party membership is a membership that is committed to Brexit, that is quite hardline on Brexit. And you would expect both candidates to take a hard line when competing for the votes of that electorate. But it is also the case, and it's been the case in British politics for a long time, that a hardcore section of Conservative MPs are committed to taking a strong line with Brussels. And I think even if you buy the argument that both candidates are exaggerating a bit because they're talking to Conservative members, it is still hard to see how either of them could get away with taking a more consensual approach to the European Union when they become prime minister because of the pressures from within their own party.
And similarly, how will this election affect the steady relationship between the UK and the US?
Well, in terms of relations on things like research, that's a very topical question, because this morning the UK signaled its intention to take the EU to court. What the British government is saying is that as part of the trading relationship, the EU agreed that the two sides would collaborate on research, but the European Commission has dragged its feet on allowing the UK access to its research programmes, which has meant that some UK academics who had been given EU funding have not been able to take up that funding. Now, there is no doubt at all in my mind that this research collaboration is being used by the European Union as a negotiating chip. That is to say, the argument from Brussels is, if you're not going to implement the Northern Ireland Protocol, don't expect us to play nicely when it comes to research or to make sure that you have full access to our research programmes, because they know we want that access. It is very hard, again, because of what I said before about the protocol, to see this being resolved. My sense is that we're moving towards a situation where the UK government tries to create its own alternative to the Horizon programme. But of course, that will be without the collaborative links to European universities that so many British researchers value so highly.
Yeah, and I guess just kind of wrapping up, if you could give us, I guess, a summary of what each candidate means for the future of the UK, especially in a post-Johnson era, that would be amazing.
Well, let me give you a really crap answer, because I'm not sure there is a good answer, is we just don't know, because we're just not certain how much of what was said in this part of the election is what they're genuinely going to do. We have no idea who either of the two candidates are going to put in their cabinet. I think, you know, with Liz Truss, what is quite clear is she will cut taxes. She's going to have to do something to cut taxes, because it was such a centerpiece of what she's argued during this campaign, and there is pressure from within the parliamentary party to do it. Above and beyond that, though, it is very, very hard. I mean, for instance, you might say, okay, logically, given everything she said, both as foreign secretary and as leadership candidate, we think Liz Truss will press ahead with the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill. But when you're prime minister, would you really press ahead with a piece of legislation that might trigger a trade war with your largest trading partner at a time of a cost of living crisis? That we just don't know. So as ever with British politics over the last 7 years, there's a massive uncertainty about what's going to happen next, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. Thank you so much for joining us today, Anand.
No worries at all. Very nice to almost meet you.
Great. Okay.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.